God knows they'd be fools to stay in business if they had a chance to get married and have a home of their own. Customers we have all of the second and third generation. Only last week I spoke to a man in Michigan. I had a very small errand to conduct over the telephone, but he and I talked at great length about his father and his uncle, who was a colonel in the Army in World War I, and about his grandfather. More than a few contacts like that, people with whom we've done business for many years. That, in spite of the fact that the whole nature of the distribution of diamonds has changed, we still keep a very strong loyalty with our customers.
What do you mean the distribution has changed?
Well, the mom and papa store in the big city is gone and taken over by the chains. But I think that this is a waste of time to talk about this. Talk about the rise of the installment jewelry business and its decline and the advent of the discount business and what I think will eventually be its comeuppance and the decline of the craftsmanship, which is common to all industries. There's no more good craftsmen left. It's hard to find a good watchmaker. It's very hard to get a good jeweler. The good jewelers are all stuck away working either in Newark or in New York in chain operations. By chain operations, I don't mean chain store operations so much as I mean in assembly line operations. And the real craftsman that could take, like, Pete Reese, a piece of metal and make a piece of jewelry out of it, there aren't any more of them.
Well, do you think this, I trust this is not digressing, the fact that a lot of emphasis being placed now on individual craftsmanship. There you have a lot of people who are going into jewelry making on their own. Do you think that's just a fad, too?
No, I don't think it's a fad, but it's not a commercial. It's not of commercial size. Some character decides that he's going to make a wild piece of jewelry. Well, he can't afford to monkey around with gold at the price of gold now. Gold is too expensive. So he makes jewelry out of silver, and he twists. It doesn't matter whether he makes a crazy, absurd design, and he calls it interesting, and takes a cheap stone and dresses it up to make it cheap stone a stone that's bought by the pound, smoky topaz, or a very bad aquamarine, or such. Not even semi-precious, the very low quality stones. And by making interesting designs, he calls it a work of art. Well, sometimes it is, more often it's not.
I think you're right. It's just that I was pursuing a personal thought of my own on that. I've been fascinated with all these interviews with you and the things you've said. And I'd like to wondered if it'd be imposing upon you to think for your own evaluation of what you feel have been your accomplishments and your successes and your failures. Have you your life broadly?
Well, I wouldn't want to wish my life on anybody else. I've had a great many tragedies in my life, which I don't know whether I overcame them or not. I did the best I could. What my accomplishments were, I would say that until 5 years after I was married to Mildred, I was a productive and innovative citizen. I made conservative Judaism respectable in Pittsburgh. For a while I was called Mr. Conservative Jew. I certainly reinvigorated education in Pittsburgh. I unquestionably was the father of the Council on Jewish Education and the subsequent College of Jewish Study. This is my creation. Then, of course, as I told you, I became president of the United Jewish Federation, not the United Jewish Fund. And it was at the time of my presidency that the groundwork was laid. As a matter of fact, more than the groundwork and the superstructure. Groundwork was laid and the superstructure built, preparing for the amalgamation of the United Jewish Fund and the United Jewish Appeal and the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies. So that if I'm not mistaken, my successor in office was the president of what is now the UJF, the United Jewish Federation. Now, it was at that time, I think I said this previously, that I had a feeling that I wasn't well. And as it happened, my feeling was right. And I suffered a coronary in New York City. After that, I did not try any innovative plans. First, because I'd reached that stage where at that time, no, let me change that. First, because I was married to Mildred and I was very happy with her. Now, mind you, I've been a long time since Florence, between the time of Florence's death and my meeting Mildred, and my marriage to Mildred, there was a period of 20 years batting around from pillar to post, traveling all over the United States, traveling to Europe. Well, here I met a woman that I loved very dearly, and I had a home of my own, and I wasn't for, I was for not resting on my oars. It was not a question of that. I took part in all kind of community activities, but I was less apt to be in the forefront of innovative ideas. Now, if you ask me to sum up what I think of my life, I would say it's very simple. I don't think that a man is worth his salt unless he is working towards an ideal. Now, this sounds like a very pretentious sentence. I don't mean it so. This is not a conscious process in anybody's mind. But the idea that one lives for himself is abhorrent. This, again, is in the tradition which I inherited from my mother, which she inherited from her mother. And I don't know why I mentioned my mother without mentioning my father. It was certainly in his tradition. God knows. If one has the idea of living only for himself, he's no man. And there has to be some outgoingness. There has to be some giving in order to have any satisfaction, because when you've reached the years that I have now reached, you'll find that all of the material things that one has gathered together mean very, very little beyond the point of simple security. Now, I don't want to downplay security. Without security, one can be desperately unhappy. But again, security, what does that mean? How much do you need to feel secure? Not to make a comparison, but a very great man like Baruch Spinoza needed very little to live on, and he felt quite secure. Today, of course, that wouldn't be enough. But beyond the point of having a decent roof over your head and reasonably presentable clothes and enough to eat, all the rest is just fanciful frosting on the cake. And the happiness that one gets consists of those endeavors that one engages in for the betterment of life in general, for the betterment of fellow men, for the betterment of an ideal. Now, if one is a studious person, one reads and studies and knows what the ideal is. If he's not a studious person, he nevertheless devotes himself instinctively, or not instinctively, he devotes himself without a clear-cut idea of why he is devoting himself. But certainly the idea of service and help to fellow man has to be paramount in any person's life for him to amount to anything at all. Now, when I say that, It sounds very pretentious because I remember having said in an earlier tape that the greatest blows that I took in my life, I used the expression bloody nose and bleeding head, I got not for my business, because my business, however difficult, managed to get along, but I got from the infighting that takes place in public life due to differences of opinion and jealousy and so on. Now,
but was it worth it? I mean, even those bloody noses, even with the infighting, because you still felt you were being helpful to someone.
Yes, but I don't want to leave the feeling that I was being helpful to someone. I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do that. Mm-hmm. What kind of man are you if you live only for yourself? Mm-hmm. And this is no original thought with mine. It's in the Pirkei Avos. If I'm for myself alone, what good am I? Mm-hmm. Any boy can pick up the ethics of the fathers and find that I think it was Hillel that said that, and Hillel lived about 2,000 years ago. So this is no new idea in Jewish life. Where I may have differed from other men in Pittsburgh is this. I didn't realize this until my 75th birthday, my Susie came here and arranged a birthday party for me, much to my dismay, because I didn't want any party. And one of the invited guests to that party was Louis Kaplan, who, as you know, is one of the deans of the community, a very bright man, and a man that has served the community well. And without being asked to, he volunteered. He got to his feet and he made a toast to me, and he said I had been the spirit of dissent all of my life. And I find that that is so. I was never willing to go along with what the accepted or popular or fashionable thing was. I can enumerate the causes that I undertook that were not fashionable. Now they are fashionable. Now, it's the same as my mother taking something out of nowhere and creating something out of it. For myself, there was a need and it was not the general idea. I mentioned the creation of the College of Jewish Studies. How a certain man whose name I did not say then and I won't say now because he's dead, let him lie in peace. He said, you create this over my dead body. Well, I created it anyhow. And I told him, I hope not over your dead body. But I did create it. And I didn't have to kill him in doing it. I don't think he liked me very much the rest of his life, but that is the truth. Now, look, let's sum this all up. Last night I was in a certain mood. I would say rather a depressed mood. And today I picked my favorite book, the book of Ecclesiastes. And I read it again, particularly the last of the 12th chapter, which contains some of the most beautiful Hebrew and some of the most beautiful English that any man can ever find. Ecclesiastes, you know, is supposed to be a kind of negative book, a sad book, a doubting book. But I can't help reading the very end of sentence 13, where it says, Sof Dover Hakol, the end of the matter, all having been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole man. For God shall bring every work into the judgment concerning every hidden thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now the interesting thing is, you notice the last words, whether it be good or whether it be evil. In Hebrew, it says im tov, im ra. Ra means bad. But there was a tradition. You never ended a book on a bad idea. So the following words are added. The last sentence, sov dover hakol, and so on. But the final words are shmor, ki zeh kol ho'adam. And the translation is, the end of the matter, all having been heard, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole man. Now, I'm not going to try to compete with Ecclesiastes. But it's laid forth there so simple. If you're a decent man, you live decently, and you do the best you can, and that's all you can do. If you've been gifted, if you've come from a good tradition, if you've come from a good discipline, you do well. If you don't, you do negatively. If you come from a bad discipline, you do bad. Well, I'm glad to say that I did not come from a bad discipline. I came from a good discipline, and I hope I did well.
Well, I'd like to add my words, because I've worked with you, Jake, for many years, ever since I moved into Pittsburgh in 45, and I think that you attained your goal. And if dissent means accomplishment and the stirring of impulses on a reluctant community, I call it good, because I think good came out of it. And I consider it a real privilege to have had the opportunity to interview you.